This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we continue our discussion of last week's stunning development. Former President Donald Trump faces 37 felony charges related to the alleged mishandling of hundreds of classified documents, unlawfully retaining them after leaving the White House, and then conspiring to obstruct a federal probe of the matter. It bears underscoring that this is the first federal indictment against a former president in American history. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. But if you heard Donald Trump's narrative of the well-substantiated 37 counts against him, including violations of the Espionage Act, you would think that he was an innocent man and that the Department of Justice had been, quote, weaponized against him for political reasons. He is, after all, running to be the 2024 presidential nominee for the Republican Party. However, in the American judicial system, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. Analysts say that Mr. Trump apparently chose to portray himself as a victim of the justice system to signal to his supporters that he was being unfairly targeted. However, Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, who was designated by Attorney General Merrick Garland to investigate Trump's alleged criminal actions, begs to differ.
Adherence to the rule of law is a bedrock principle of the Department of Justice, and our nation's commitment to the rule of law sets an example for the world. We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone. Applying those laws, collecting facts, that's what determines the outcome of an investigation. Nothing more and nothing less.
That was Special Prosecutor Jack Smith speaking on Friday, June 9, after the indictment was unsealed. Simply put, no one, not even a sitting or former president, is above the law. At the arraignment in a Miami courthouse on Tuesday, June 13, Mr. Trump's lawyer entered a plea of not guilty. Nonetheless, legal experts say that neither the law nor the facts appear to be on Donald Trump's side. On this edition of the program, we will examine the political ramifications of this watershed moment, but also the grave national security implications with Tess Bridgman. She is a co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. That's an online forum for the rigorous analysis of security, democracy, foreign policy, and rights. And Bill Galston, he's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent think tank here in Washington. And both panelists join me via Zoom. Tess Bridgman, I'd like to begin with you. What are the concrete national security implications of this indictment, especially regarding violations of the Espionage Act?
Thanks. Yeah, that's a question that's on a lot of people's minds. And it's because this is an incredibly serious set of allegations in terms of the national security implications. The former president is charged with 31 counts under the Espionage Act, each for a different classified document that he knowingly retained and failed to return to the U.S. government despite repeated requests to do so. He also, of course, concealed the fact that he still had those documents and lied about them, which gives rise to the obstruction charges. But from a national security perspective, we have to worry first about what's in the documents themselves. Information is classified if its disclosure would harm national security. A lot of the documents are at the top secret level and require special handling even beyond that, which means that their disclosure would cause exceptionally grave damage to national security. We have a list of the documents with rather general descriptors, but we get a clear flavor of the gravity of the contents of these documents: military plans, nuclear secrets, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack. These are the kinds of documents that other countries' intelligence agencies would go to almost any lengths to try to get their hands on. So the actual information in these documents themselves is highly sensitive. Their potential compromise would be grave. We also know that regardless of whether foreign intelligence agents have succeeded in getting into Mar-a-Lago or getting to people with whom Trump has discussed these documents or showed them, that Trump has knowingly disseminated the information in these these documents to people without a security clearance. So it's not just hypothetical. And the indictment walks through two instances of that, but we have to question, are there others? We also have to be concerned about the potential compromise of sources and methods. So with documents this sensitive, and with the kind of information that a former president was able to handle while in office that former President Trump took with him, they can often indicate, at least with some level of generality, if not with specificity, not just what we know, but how we know it. So human intelligence sources, signals intelligence platforms, sensitive imagery collection, these kinds of intelligence streams could be compromised as well. And some of those might be irreplaceable. Some may have taken years and many resources to build up. And people's lives could be at risk if sources are compromised. Likewise, the corollary, some of these intelligence streams are relied upon to keep, say, U.S. troops in the field safe. So these risks are incredibly grave from a national security perspective. And one last one that I'll just highlight at the outset is the loss of trust from allies and partners. So a lot of our information collected by the intelligence community comes from cooperation with foreign intelligence agencies, partners, and allies who trust us with their secrets because past administrations acted with professionalism and appropriate confidentiality. So part of the problem here is, will intelligence agencies continue to cooperate with us? Will they continue to trust us with their secrets if even a former president of the United States, who's once again a front runner for one of our major political parties, cannot be trusted to handle them? So there are a lot of grave issues here stemming from not just the indictment, but the pattern of practice that it represents on the part of the former president.
A lot of grave issues, Bill Galston, and yet former President Trump sometimes makes light of them. And we saw how he treated these documents at Mar-a-Lago. He took them knowingly and then stored them in bathrooms and ballrooms and other places. And now he's saying that this is some sort of a witch hunt against him. So what do you make of this narrative of his?
I make two things of it. First of all, it's not true. And second, most of the people who support him believe it. And that is, I think, the essence of the situation that we find ourselves in, where the loyalty of Mr. Trump's supporters is, I think, unshakable. And he said to widespread incredulity during his first presidential campaign that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would stick with him. And that's turned out to be the literal truth almost. And this raises the question of what, if anything, will shake the confidence of Trump supporters in their leader. This is an extremely important set of charges, but they are unlikely to be the last set of charges. There's an investigation going on about ballot and vote tampering in Georgia, spearheaded by the former president. There is another federal investigation underway about Mr. Trump's role in perhaps stimulating or even catalyzing the events of January 6th. Mr. Trump has already been indicted more times than he's been elected president. He's already been convicted, although it was not a criminal case, in New York City. And I am beginning to doubt that anything that happens in the next 17 months will shake the fervent support that he now enjoys. It remains to be seen whether swing voters are going to be influenced. The elections in recent years have been excruciatingly close. And based on the survey evidence so far, it seems likely that the 2024 presidential election will be another closely run affair.
So back to you, Tess Bridgman. All of this is all the more concerning if, in fact, former President Trump's supporters are impervious to facts and see this as a political exercise. That must, too, be some sort of a national security threat, would you not say?
There is, I think, a broader issue with respect to imperviousness to fact. And that's something that is indeed a huge national security risk if former President Trump were to be reelected, or if someone who similarly seeks to use information for their own personal benefit is again in the White House. You know, we saw not just instances of compromise of classified information when Trump was in office, you know, impulsive disclosures during meetings with the Russian foreign minister, a tweet of a sensitive image of an Iranian facility, as reported, attempts to declassify counterintelligence investigations, all for personal political gain. Those are politics for the former president, or they're just personal impulse. But either way, they're obviously huge national security risks. They undermine the intelligence community's ability to collect information, and they undermine our ability to keep that information secure once the U.S. government has it. So to the extent that we see an increasingly fever-pitched campaign season where the former president knows that his best chance of, you know, avoiding criminal jeopardy would be getting back into the White House before that jeopardy attaches, we could potentially see a lot more of that kind of compromise of our most sensitive national security information for personal political benefit. So I would say that that, to me, is how the continuing political drama fits into the ongoing national security risk that's presented.
Back to you before we take a quick break, Bill Galston. We keep hearing about former President Trump saying, well, what about Biden? What about his documents? What about former Vice President Pence? State once and for all the stark differences between those cases and what's facing former President Trump in this indictment.
Well, let's pick out the most obvious differences between the Biden and Pence events on the one hand and Mr. Trump's on the other. First of all, there is zero evidence that either Mr. Biden, after he left the vice presidency, or Mr. Pence, after he left the vice presidency, knowingly took any national security related documents with them. And there is a lot of evidence to the effect that Mr. Trump deliberately took the documents because he wanted them for purposes that are not yet clear. And also, it's becoming increasingly clear because he regarded them as his property, the various government records acts, to the contrary, notwithstanding. The second, and I think even more significant difference, is that when Biden and Pence were informed of their possession of these documents and then undertook a search of their own and found more, they did not in any way attempt either to deny the existence of these documents or resist returning them to the federal government archives where they belonged. And many of the charges in the indictment, as Tess indicated, pertain to Mr. Trump's knowing effort to obstruct justice and to obstruct the return of the documents. So those are two really critical differences.
And we will have more in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Tess Bridgman. She's co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, and that's an online forum for the analysis of security, democracy, foreign policy, and rights. And Bill Galston, from whom you just heard, he's senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution, and we're discussing the national security implications of Donald Trump's indictment. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may also download the show at voanews.com/encounter. You may follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. And back to you, Tess Bridgman, looking again at the very dire national security implications. As you said, Trump kept documents on military and nuclear programs at his Florida estate, including information on U.S. and foreign countries' defense and weapons capabilities, U.S. nuclear programs, even U.S. vulnerabilities to potential military attacks and plans for possible retaliation in response to foreign attacks. All of these should remain top secret. What are you hearing in terms of what our allies are saying about this development? Even though the trial hasn't started, you know, right now, what are we hearing and how much damage would you say has been done so far?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's hard to know exactly how much damage has been done. And I am sure that the professionals in the intelligence community and in our foreign policy community are working very closely with counterparts right now to try to mitigate damage. Exactly what that means, I think, is an open question as far as the public is aware. But you can imagine that with information this sensitive and with sources that appear to be this sensitive, the intelligence community is likely already having to presume that some of this information is compromised. They may need to be dropping potential sources or programs. They may need to be taking other measures to mitigate that fallout in terms of sharing procedures with with allies or partners. We just don't know right now. But all of that, of course, is needlessly provoked by the former president's reckless behavior and could be made worse if we see other disclosures in this political season or in the course of the prosecution. Of course, the prosecution itself opens up another kind of critical moment where the U.S. government and defense attorneys will have to try to strike the right balance between what they want to talk about and show in court and what needs to remain appropriately classified and confidential. So there'll be some really difficult issues there. And my guess is that the prosecutors will go out of their way to make sure that the evidence that may have come from foreign partners, from partner intelligence agencies, will be, I would imagine, the most zealously protected, unless, of course, they have the consent of that foreign partner to make any limited disclosure that might be needed in order to uphold, you know, the constitutional rights of the defendant, former President Trump, who, as you rightly note at the beginning, needs to be presumed innocent until proven guilty insofar as the trial proceeds in a court of law. So these are a lot of really sensitive issues that the prosecution and the intelligence agencies and foreign policy community, our State Department friends, are having to navigate right now. I have no doubt that they are doing so with seriousness and professionalism, but it remains to be seen whether there's continuing fallout.
So back to you, Bill Galston, to talk about some of the political implications. You said that you believe that loyalty to Donald Trump is unshakable by his most fervent supporters. What about some members of Congress and other Republican officials? Many have come out in his defense. Others have criticized a couple of candidates, the likes of former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Do you think that there will be a shift in that perspective from some of his, let's say, adversaries in the primary? You know, how will Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida extricate himself from former President Trump and try to overtake him? How do you see this playing out over time as the prosecution goes forward? How will, you know, minds change among some of these Republicans?
A couple of points in response, Carol. First of all, you've already seen more dissent, more criticism of former President Trump from Republican Party elected officials and political operatives such as Karl Rove. You've seen former Attorney General William Barr, who was quite zealous in his defense of Mr. Trump when he was Attorney General, criticizing his conduct in no uncertain terms. And as you mentioned, more than one announced candidate for the Republican nomination, not only Chris Christie, but also Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, are criticizing him. And some candidates, Nikki Haley for one, who was initially foursquare in her support, said after reading the actual language of the indictment that it was stronger than she expected, but that she was not about to jump on the prosecutorial bandwagon. The indictment of former President Trump has had the effect of putting every candidate for the presidency and candidates for other offices as well on the spot. They are not free to remain silent. Unlike people accused of crimes, there is no Miranda warning for political candidates. If they remain silent, that can cost them. If they speak, depending on what they say, that can also cost them. And many of them are in a situation where whatever position they take, they are going to potentially lose support from one faction of the party, even as they may gain it from another. So it's a very complex political situation. And many candidates and elected officials are worried that if they take a firm position, facts may come out running up to or in the trial that could undercut their initial public reaction to the indictments. So this is a problem. And there's no question about the fact also that rank and file Republicans are hearing a wider mix of views in response to Mr. Trump's indictment than they have for quite some time. And if they are inclined to listen, they may be influenced by alternate perspectives. The point I made earlier, however, is consistent with this potential openness, and that is that Mr. Trump, according to all the surveys, commands the strong support of nearly half of the Republican Party, I would say 40 to 45% minimum, and peeling away any appreciable part of that support in response to the events that we're discussing strikes me as being quite unlikely.
Well, back to you, Tess Bridgman. And this is sort of an elementary question, and it's not like we can go back and change history. But my question is, how could these documents have been taken in such volume by former President Trump? Was there not some sort of a monitoring process in place that might have been able to prevent this from happening in the first place, you know, in the process of his staff packing and allowing all of these boxes? It just seems odd to me. But I was just wondering, since you have quite a bit of experience, you know, in the executive branch, could this not have been somehow mitigated or prevented from happening?
It is odd, and it should be troubling that he was able to take such a volume of information, classified and otherwise. It's important to keep in mind as well that a lot of the other information he took, records in those boxes, are government records and property of the United States. Of course, we're most concerned about those highly classified documents. But part of this goes to the unprecedented nature of the way Trump acted when in office. He reportedly began hoarding documents in his residence in the White House well before he left office and was in the habit of hanging on to things for reasons other than doing his day and night job of being president of the United States. So while it is not at all unheard of for presidents to take, you know, the book of information that they need to digest for the night, of memos they need to sign off on, decisions they need to make, to their residence with them, that usually comes back to the West Wing in the morning, you know, to the Oval Office. And that process really broke down under the Trump presidency from what's been publicly reported. So it started with having, I think, this large volume of materials already in unusual places and with unusual custodians. And then, of course, gets exacerbated by the fact that at bottom, the system is built on the president having the authority to control the information that is in large measure designed to support him and to support the decisions of those that work for him in conducting, you know, the foreign policy in the defense of the United States. So while he was president, he did have the authority to decide which information he should process in his residence. It is something that I think will be looked at afresh now that these, you know, normal protocols were able to be so thoroughly circumvented. But at bottom, no one had abused that authority in the way that Trump had before. And it's one of the many ways that we see abuse of norms and willingness to completely disregard established ways of operating professionally show real weaknesses in our institutions. And this is one of the troubling ways that that has been highlighted by what came during the 4 years of the Trump presidency. In terms of, though, actually bringing the boxes onto the plane that departed, absolutely, it shows that there is going to need to be in the future some sort of screening process in that moment. Transitions are always chaotic. I'm sure this transition was more chaotic than most because of the January 6th insurrection and the former president claiming he was still in power, among other things. So when you're already in that kind of bizarro world where the normal is turned upside down, when there's that high degree of recklessness and of disregard for the duties of the office and for, in this case, the information that Trump was allowed to retain and handle, it's hard to know whether he would have been stoppable up until the point where he was no longer president. So up until noon on January 20th, it's not clear what would have stopped him from doing what he did. And that's a deep vulnerability in the system that this whole episode highlights.
Well, you get the last word, Bill Galston.
Well, let me make just a couple of points in conclusion. First of all, building on Tess's previous remarks about document handling, I was in a White House, Bill Clinton's White House, and I can tell you that when I left, it was on the honor system for all practical purposes. I did not take documents with me, but I sure could have because nobody was supervising me. It wasn't as though there was some sort of master inventory of documents and I was required to have a document corresponding to each one on the list before I dropped it into a box that would be sent to the National Archives. The system doesn't work like that, not at all. And at the end of administrations, things are particularly chaotic, usually because there's ongoing business in a presidency right up until the last moment. The packing of documents is done in great haste as a result, and mistakes happen. As we've seen, they've happened to two former vice presidents who happened to be running for president in 2024, and each of them ended up with documents that he shouldn't have had, didn't know were being conveyed to his personal residence. So there's a lot of tightening up that needs to happen, but there's no guarantee under current circumstances that that's going to happen unless the people in office are both honorable and scrupulous.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Tess Bridgman, co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, and Bill Galston, senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.